This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
As you may have heard, a friend of ours passed away over at Zen Center yesterday. And apparently by suicide. This is someone that I've known for a little while, not super well, but this is someone whose life narrative was very tightly bound up with quite difficult feelings. Probably feelings that we're all familiar with. Unworthiness, being unloved, unable to make connection, worthlessness, and so forth. Notwithstanding that, this person, I think, was quite... people felt quite warmly towards him. And but for some reason, no matter how often people conveyed that, it seemed like it could not enter the tight coils of the narrative that he was weaving over the course of his life. So this is very difficult for us. When someone kills himself or herself, of course, our thoughts turn to that person and his or her difficulties, but also the so-called the survivors have some challenge. Sometimes suicide is a kind of attack or an assault on others. Not always, I don't think, but sometimes. It's an extremely, almost the ultimate aggression, because there is no way to respond to the person at all. But sometimes it's simply what looks to be the final option. There's just no other choice, no other route. No possibility. So, I've actually known, I had three close friends commit suicide since my teenage years. And each time, of course, one thinks, you know, was there something I should have done or should have said, some intervention I should have made? What should I have done? And usually I could always see, yeah, something maybe I should have or not done or something. But by then it's all retrospective. The late founding abbot Isan said somewhere, I can't remember where, I think recently I saw this, somebody I think asked him, if there's all this dukkha around, why don't we just kill ourselves? And I think he replied, because it won't help. And from the Buddhist point of view, it certainly won't. Buddha made it quite clear that you don't outrun your karma. Nothing runs faster than karma. So the apparent lure of some kind of cessation is... an illusion. from the Buddhist point of view, and probably some others. And yet, it probably also it's important for us to be able to recognize that there's also no blame. This is our life, and Buddha's teaching seems to be the resolution of dukkha is in dukkha itself. The opening of that mystery is in dukkha, not somewhere else. So our attempts to fly to some place of ease and safety are doomed to failure. Whether we think suicide or some drug or some spiritual practice or some person or some change of venue will open that door, it actually doesn't make any difference. Of course, this isn't the same as saying that we shouldn't try to change situations where change is necessary. But the kind of change that Buddha spoke of only occurs here. And in giving birth to this change, of course, Sangha is indispensable. The path of the so-called Pratyeka Buddha, the solitary enlightened one, has, the Mahayana kind of left by the roadside many centuries ago. It's okay, but it's not that helpful. It's difficult to see in that path any concern for others. Rather, there's the perhaps the dominant perception that others are only provisionally there anyway, so why bother with them? They'll figure it out, some kalpa or other. Me, I'm out of here. So instead, we over and over again embrace and are embraced by Sangha in our expression of the Bodhisattva vow. To practice in the place of dukkha for, I don't know, as long as it takes. As long as there is a single being still apparently stuck in wrong view, the Bodhisattva returns again and again and again to that single place of practice. It would be a little disingenuous to say that it's not difficult, right? It's a little difficult, I admit. And yet, there's nothing quite as satisfying nothing quite as satisfying as giving space and expression to what Suzuki Roshi called the inmost request. Which is what we do over and over again in practice. Inmost request. I don't know exactly what that means, and yet somehow it fits. It's a way of talking about something that can't be satisfied by anything short of the, perfect expression of being, which is ours by nature. However much we may wobble and wander. So the, by now, tremendous quantity of Buddhist scriptures is laden with instructions. And all of them really can be distilled down to honor your inmost request. Yesterday morning service, we chanted the Metta Sutta, the Sutta of Loving Kindness, which ends with another of these prescriptions. Something like abandoning vague discussions. How's it go? Abandoning vague discussions, having a clear insight. Freed from sense appetites. One who manifests perfection will no longer know rebirth. In the cycle of the creation of suffering for ourselves or others. So that's another of these pithy instructions. First, let's abandon vague discussions. So I should probably shut up. But I haven't been talking very long, so maybe I'll continue for a few more minutes. Anyway, we should abandon vague discussions, whatever those are. For instance, in fruitless pursuit of metaphysical themes, which is favored in some branches of, maybe to say Western philosophy, sorry, also Eastern philosophy, abandoning vague discussion endowed with insight, that is, having studied reality carefully and, might say, mercilessly, we see how things actually function. This mind, this body-mind, how does it actually work in the context of unfolding life? Is it true what Buddha said, that there is no occasion when grasping will not entail suffering? And there is no occasion when grasping is not based on wrong view. Is that true? Well, let's find out for ourselves. And in so doing, something called insight arises. And as insight arises, you could say, oh, then perhaps we will be free from sense appetites. Personally, I don't think we can look forward to not having any sense appetites as long as we have a body, body-mind. But we don't have to be bewildered by them, benumbed by them, bewitched by them. in the midst of the energetic, life-fueled arising of desire, we can still honor our inmost request, which is not to be led around by the ephemeral. And in as this effort unfolds over, I don't know, perhaps some eons, I don't know, it says achieves, but I think maybe better is like manifests perfection. And I think perfection means the inmost request to recognize and abide in the world as pure being is established. And thereupon, the karmic roller coaster towards birth after birth is interrupted. And those births, as we know, entail suffering for the one born and all the others around. So the practice of perfection is another name for what we do. And of course, it sounds very strange, since in the midst of our sitting, we probably don't feel like, here I am, perfectly manifesting the Buddha way. But that's okay, it is not required, and in fact, it's not recommended to have that thought, here I am, perfectly manifesting the Buddha way. It's also recommended that we not spend time in the other direction. Here I am, miserably expressing a warped version of the Buddha way. Terrible, terrible. That's also not helpful. Neither of those is necessary. Dogen tells us, you are already expressing the perfect unfolding of Buddha's way without any fiddling with that on our part. And this is how we sit in peace. The peace of the vitality of that inmost request. Day after day, life after life. And the more we do that, the more, as Sukhrishi says, you know, you'll have some wonderful power, which actually you won't be able to name or particularly characterize. But when someone needs help, you may be able to be present for that. And help will be available even if you don't think, I can now help. In fact, that often gets in the way. Still, it's not possible to shoulder the burden of someone else's karma. I realize there's some dispute about this in Buddhism, but I haven't seen it done convincingly, and Buddha seems to have said, nope, that does not happen. But being in the context, practicing the context of Sangha, does seem to kind of make our apparent burdens a little easier to bear. So I thank you for being here to practice with. If I had to practice all by myself, I probably would. Or maybe not. I'm not sure. I might just stay in bed. But since y'all are here, I get to practice with you. We had a little little kind of suicide prevention training here a couple of weeks ago, which is very interesting. But I don't remember that the presenter, quite good woman whose name I can't remember, of course. I don't think she said, "Don't bother with suicide, it won't help." That might be interesting to include in their literature. It might stop people. It's like, wait, what? What do you mean it won't help? That's my ace in the hole. You can say, actually, no, it's not. Maybe that would actually help some people. So that the painful gift of this life would not be lightly set aside. In some act of desperation. I wrote a little poem as I was contemplating all this. I'm not sure if my increasingly unreliable memory will cooperate, but maybe. I think it goes, now distant enough, all fabled lands are like a long ago dream. The path winds amid towering dunes, mice and beetles busy in the dusk, trudging ever homeward, sandals whispering softly, softly. The autumn moon for company, the evening wind for song. Please remember that the place of peace is here, where you are, nowhere else. And if you trust nothing else in this life, trust that and your fellow practitioners, your fellow people of the way. And even if things seem very dark, you can trust the eye of wisdom, which apprehends light that the fleshy eye can't see. And you don't get that from someone else. Do you have some questions today?
I heard a while ago that from a psychotherapy sort of perspective, meditation isn't an effective therapy against types of major depression, mm-hmm. but it can prevent relapses, but it's not a treatment. And so I'm wondering if there are certain states of mind or states of being that are much less able to deal with what's demanded in practice, and the insights that can arise we are prevented from from coming up.
Mm. Well, the question begs many others. There was a lengthy letter to the New York Times, I think last Sunday, not this Sunday, Sunday before, by the psychiatrist woman who wrote Listening to Prozac. And one thing that struck me as I read the whole thing was it was quite clear in her mind that there is a disease called depression. And yet, it's a little difficult to pin that down, what exactly that is. Certainly, people report various inner phenomena and have observable behaviors. But as I have talked about before, once those phenomena acquired a label, depression, the label became the explanation of the phenomena. Oh, you're like that because you have depression. Not, depression is being like that. You're like that because of depression. I think it was Gregory Bateson who first pointed that out. He found that very strange. He said, when did the label become the cause? This was never mentioned in her letter. So there's a whole sea of unknowns in what you bring up. Nonetheless, Buddha also said, you know, a certain degree of health is probably necessary for practice. Not very much, actually. Even just a minimal amount. And failing that, you know, you may need to work at health first before being able to be quiet in the place of practice without thrashing around too much. And it's possible that certain conditions that are now recognized and labeled in the current medical climate resist that. I actually don't know. But others have pointed out, what if the label itself is a problem now? What if calling something, what if using the name of something as the cause is trapping people in some kind of inescapable cycle? Now we're going to treat you for depression, which is the name of how you feel. And also the cause of how you feel. Like, this is like a little bit crazy. Bateson called this an error of logical type. Or logical category. So it's not so easy to say. I think there's a certain amount of evidence that certain kinds of illnesses do respond to a treatment with medicine. And some people, apparently, I'm not clear on all the details, but some folks with the most pernicious and persistent kind of depression in particular can benefit from taking medicine. And that may make it possible for them to hear once again their inmost request, which is kind of beneath all of the turmoil that they may be associating as their life. But another question that comes up is, when someone says meditation, what are they talking about? There's a whole universe of stuff under that label. So if someone says, well, meditation is not good for depression, I would think it would be necessary to find out first, what do they mean by those terms? What do they mean by meditation? What do they mean by depression? So it's a deep question. It may be that just about every individual case needs individual treatment and study and handling. risk.
As regards feelings of depression, I think that's a series of widening circles with different names and different feelings, but mm-hmm. often at the center there's a feeling of not being loved
mm-hmm.
or being alone, and I'm not quite sure how, if at all, to differentiate those two terms.
Mm-hmm.
And the kindred word, lonely,
yes.
along with alone.
Yes.
And some months ago, in a talk with a friend, I had been doing a zazen, which had been dwindling at home for some years. And so I brought up the notion of Sangha, and whatever is. And he was very insistent that, well, there are the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha. And mm-hmm. incidentally, I started reading more Dharma,
mm-hmm.
starting with the Buddha's early words in that, in the Theravada.
Mm-hmm.
Which turned out, apparently, by the way, not to be necessarily not found also in the Mahayana.
Mm-hmm.
But, so I took this to heart and started coming here,
mm-hmm.
mainly to Jennifer's because of certain medical interventions that I have to go through.
Mm-hmm.
That prevent the morning and then in the evening some other health considerations.
Mm-hmm.
So Jennifer's at 10:30 is very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I also try to come here. Can't always make it to the zazen beforehand because of these same considerations.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost always can get here to the lecture. And I found that just coming here is a very great help in itself. And in two ways. You know, when you can give love, of course you feel more love.
Mm-hmm.
May I be so bold if you wouldn't mind of using a personal example, you referred to yourself of falling on the kitchen floor and the help people around you gave. Well, I mean, do you not think that the ability to respond was not at least as helpful and as locomotive and as much of a gift
mm-hmm.
to those who were around?
I'd also point out that it's helpful to have you come here, that I appreciate that very much, seeing you here. So it goes both ways. This is part of the marvel of Sangha, is that it goes both ways.
Yeah.
And what keeps coming to my mind about our friend who died is that, you know, people liked him so much. Why could he never hear that? What is it that could not penetrate? That's a mystery. Because, as you point out, this, as I agree with, this goes both ways. Reaches both ways, in and out.
I didn't quite get to my question.
Oh, sorry. I beg your pardon.
But yet, and I myself feel really needy for love,
mm-hmm.
for different reasons. And many people say, well, how can you look at all the people I see you with and you're always going to do this? But there are many reasons why I still feel that way and have for the past 2 years. I didn't dare even to hope, but wished for was a relief in Sangha.
Mm-hmm.
There are two aspects of Sangha I've begun to think about. One is that people should help and even love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be an occasion when this can take place at an almost unparalleled degree.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, countermanding the expressions of love for each other, at the same time, our whole set of regulations and manners of deportment that are required, that it can't be interfered with.
Hmm.
On the other hand, there are some free times, like upstairs after lecture, when it's possible that one can, bring oneself more and more to the habit of trying to see in others the pain that they have,
mm-hmm.
and in some way, perhaps, training oneself more and more to address that in the occasions in which it's proper and not improper to do that.
So, sorry, your question is that.
So the question is kind of like of the limits of that.
Uh-huh.
I myself would want an unlimited love. Partly, this is my Catholic background,
mm-hmm.
and you will know what I mean.
I do
the same thing.
Yes.
Of, you know, great hugs and kisses and almost a ceremonial nature and
mm-hmm.
vast expressions of joy at seeing people
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, there's a certain dourness, not so much here, but still to some extent.
Mm.
And much more a sin center mm-hmm. than I thought, anyway, that I felt.
Yeah.
And so I guess my question, to be less verbose, is if you could help me find how you determine the line between the right times and places and manners of expressing love and responding and addressing
mm-hmm.
the pains of others and when not.
Mm-hmm. Well, ironically, this sense of aloneness and alienation and isolation is precisely what practice aims at and eventually dissolves. So I want to throw that out there as my actual experience. We can't quite throw our hat in that ring just yet, then I think I would just rely on circumstances to determine what's an appropriate expression, and if I'm wrong sometimes, well, tough. If I, we're sitting down here for Zazen and I wander around the Zendo kissing everyone, that might be a little funny, you know. But, okay, well, tough. That's a mistake. One of the joys of Sangha is its ability to contain mistakes, of which all of us make many, at least I do. So I would just trust myself and others help us as a sangha determine, you know, what seems like a good expression, and if it's on occasion it's awkward or seems poorly timed, well, so what? It's not the end of the world. But to me, the bottom line is practice speaks to this alienation eloquently. And that is most important. Because once that starts to yield, once that sense of isolation starts to yield, a number of other possibilities open up for oneself and for persons in one's own circle. So that's why I keep coming back again and again to urging us all to practice the Buddha way and just trust it and see what happens and see this sense of aloneness and alienation begin to dissolve. Because it takes energy to maintain it, by the way. It's actually quite draining to maintain our sense of separateness. It's actually kind of our main job as we're conscious. And as the fluidity of that boundary begins to reveal itself, things change. So, as somebody said, it gets better. Not just if you're a gay teenager, but for all of us. Yes, did you want to say something?
You know, the thing about depression that I think people that aren't directly involved in it fail to appreciate is that it's like being like in quicksand.
Uh-huh.
The more you try to pull yourself out,
mm-hmm.
the more you kind of sink in.
Uh-huh.
And it's not something that you can, you know, reason with.
Manipulate, move around.
Move around, mm-hmm. have the tools to deal with.
Mm.
You know, if someone, you know, somehow can, you know, extend a branch and you have something to grab onto,
uh-huh.
well then, you know, maybe you can pull out, yeah. in which case you're no longer in depression.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those, you know, states that...
For some of those people, it may be the branch is the medicine.
It can be.
Yeah.
If that's you know what it takes. I mean, yeah. some people can't even reach for the medicine or reach for the branch.
Apparently, yes.
Then you know the bottom drops out.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's you know, just you know, easy not to. Appreciate or understand. I mean, I don't think it's that it's the labeling. I think it's the living, the experience of that, you know, kind of ultimate nihilistic emptiness. You know, I'm probably elucidating the obvious, but it's really sad.
Yeah.
How old was this person?
40-something. Yeah. And a delightful fellow. Very funny and charming and warm-hearted. It's like, what the fuck? Excuse my language. Yes.
So, you say, why couldn't he hear the message?
Yeah, I guess.
And I think that the message could go through, but it's not enough. He's so sad and alienated that mm-hmm. he could hear these messages, but when he went back to his quarters,
yeah.
I don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
That's an idea.
I guess that must be the case.
I don't know.
Yeah. To look at him, you wouldn't think so, you know. He was at Tassajara when I was there as Tonto, and we had some very good visits and talks, and yet you would see him periodically, you know, you'd look at him and see like the sun behind the cloud completely. It's like whatever this was coming out again, this karmic burden or whatever it was manifesting itself over and over again.
And I think that what people did, even if it wasn't conscious, to extend themselves, that sangha mm-hmm. kind of synergy you talk about,
yeah.
they tried. Even if they weren't conscious,
sure.
they tried.
Sure.
I don't know.
I think, from what I saw, that's true. People tried a lot. And yet...
And how much is physiological?
And how much is physiological? That's, again, I think very poorly understood at this time. Very, very hard to know.
From what I've read on the Enos blog,
mm-hmm.
And I don't know how much of his financial troubles were a factor in his committing suicide. But from the way that the you know, said that was a major source of stress on his life.
Yeah, he had been unable to find work like millions of other people at this point.
And I think it, you know, you might think that, you know, it's just mind troubles. Why I think that is reason to kill yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like I can really relate to that sense of worthlessness, because I think it goes back to what Nick was talking about, being in a practice setting. Because for me, when I left really suddenly last fall from Harker Street, not being able to find a job,
mm-hmm.
and the shame of not being able to pay tuition here,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I was taking advantage of the people that I loved,
mm-hmm.
and I think that can be sangha, or that can be family, or, you know, the financial burden translates into an emotional burden.
And as we know, money has a deep symbolic side, and especially in this culture, and especially in a culture where there's a certain Protestant ethic. If you don't have any money, it means God doesn't love you. And if God doesn't love you, why should I? And this is runs on just under the surface of this culture from, I think, coast to coast. So the symbolic power of money is something it's best not to lose sight of. Of course, we give lots of money to athletes and movie stars, but not to teachers. How about that? Yes. You're a teacher. Yes.
I was just going to share a dream, because I have these vivid dreams because of these strong drugs I take from the doctor.
Yeah. These are prescription drugs in this case.
And I don't know, but it just kept coming back. And I'm sure it had to do with yesterday's news as well. It was just sort of suspended in space, where these sort of transparent, egg-shaped sort of cubicles, like, and there were these little beings inside, and they were pulling. There was like a little hatch there, and there was a handle on it, and they kept pulling the door shut like this and saying, "I want love, I want love," and there's millions of them, "I want love, I want love."
Fascinating.
And in the background there was this beautiful, like, siren song kind of voice saying, "Just let go."
Oh.
And the door would open, and they would all hear each other saying that.
Oh.
And I'm sure it had something to do with positive, it had something to do with the sad news yesterday.
Yeah. And
probably my own relationship to that. But I don't know, I think everyone sort of touched on it a little bit in what they've said. I think they're not necessarily that we love other people or that people love us, but that sort of we allow ourselves to be a vehicle for love to manifest itself. And mm-hmm. so many times we're, at least I know I am, I'm
tagging on
holding that door, mm-hmm. you know, wanting it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Can you speak to the idea of self-talk as opposed to the dedication of a regular practice? You know, the fruits of the practice are manifested beyond the practice, but what happens with the talk that mm-hmm. we keep giving ourselves,
mm-hmm.
as
mm-hmm.
your colleague may or may not have been able to distance it? Can you speak to that idea of regular practice and what happens in that thought?
Well, you know, there are forms of so-called talk therapy now which are aimed just at that, and at the toxic nature of some of our inner dialogue, which feeds on itself and causes maybe some physiological fluctuations which feed back into that loop again and again and again, and how important it is to interrupt that, especially the endless litany of I'm terrible or I'm unlovable or on and on and on. And of course, in our particular way of cultivation, to sit down, be willing to sit down in the midst of that without necessarily trying to stop it, but to be able to watch it lose steam over time because it has to be fed to continue. And this, I think, is a difficult point for many of us, because it doesn't feel like, right, I'm not feeding this. What are you talking about? Actually, you are. We are. That's how it works. If you don't feed it, it can't continue. So to watch the energy slowly drain away from those repetitive recitations is extremely illuminating. And at first, people tend to maybe stumble on that and feel like the encounter with a certain degree of peace and silence in the midst of practice was accidental. Or they thought, no, I did A, B, and C to do that, so I'll do that again and try to get there. And this is like, no, actually, you don't even have to do that. And over time, these experiences in practice accumulate, and it's extremely freeing to realize, first of all, I'm running that dialogue. I'm spinning that wheel. And to watch it and let it slow down, slow down, slow down, and stop without trying to reach out and grab it and make it stop is this is a tremendous gift that we received from Buddhas and ancestors and whoever else you want to name. So, of course, some people will turn that around and say, well, let's meet the negative self-talk with positive, affirming self-talk. That's another way to go. It's a kind of the antidotal approach. Personally, I like the other one better, where you let it all go silent. Yeah. Are you about to speak?
Yeah.
What?
Cookies.
Sorry, yes. Doctor, I didn't know if you were about to say something.
Well, I just try to be brief because I think cookies,
yeah, cookies
are definitely part of it.
Cookies are more important.
So, so,
abandoning vague discussion.
Sounds good to me.
We can continue the vague
over
discussion
cookies. We can, over cookies. But please, if you'd like to comment.
Okay, so just very quick. I work with some case managers who are social workers who deal with people in very, very difficult situations, and are always finding creative ways to help them deal with situations that the people themselves think are absolutely impenetrable, and resulting in homelessness and overdoses. And so I was in one of their offices the other day, and I saw a list of 5 ways of coping with problems. This was something she was using to work with one of her clients. Hmm. And just the simplicity of it just hit me over the head. This is really, really good. Mm-hmm. So if you have a problem, there are 5 ways you can deal with it. The first is to try and solve it through skillful interactions with other people, usually. Mm-hmm. The second is to try and just be aware of the emotions that it brings up and work with the emotions in yourself. Mm-hmm. The third is to ignore it. Mm-hmm. The fourth is to be miserable. Mm-hmm. And the fifth is to make the situation worse.
That about covers it. Maybe we should write that down and put it on our bulletin board. Before you leave, can you do that?
Sure.
Anyway, happy to have you all to practice with.